Francis described the Friday night Vespers as starting the Memorial Day weekend with remembering, leavings, losses, and loved ones we hold dear. When I first agreed to do the service today, it was exactly that sentiment that motivated me. I thought I'd tell you about Decoration Day being the beginning of Memorial Day and how it is experienced in the South and in my family. And I will tell you more about that. I thought we might reflect on all those no longer with us, and not just soldiers who have died fighting for freedom and justice. As I'm now 4 days away from finishing 10 months of hospital chaplaincy, I have experienced much leavings and losses and could talk about those times as holy and sacred. Then another experience made me look at another way of addressing this holiday. I was sitting at a memorial service for a wonderful man from my former congregation. The person sitting next to me asked, "How did I know Bruce?" And I told her our history, that his family had come seeking a place to raise their daughters between the Christianity of his youth and his wife's Hinduism, that he brought his daughters on Sunday mornings to allow his doctor wife some precious, precious quiet time. How I had recruited Bruce to be an OWL, our whole lives sexuality educator, and how he was much loved and had touched the lives of so many youth and children by teaching OWL and religious education. When I asked her the "how do you know him" question, she said they were office mates at Fort Monmouth. After more talk about that, I had forgotten Bruce worked for the Department of Defense. I asked her if she had a faith home. She said no, that she identified as a Taoist and a pagan and had not found a place that could accommodate the variety of her beliefs. Well, of course I told her that she might find her place in Unitarian Universalism. She said she had considered it, but because she worked for the Department of Defense and she supported the military and our war efforts, she thought she would be shunned at a UU congregation. She asked me outright if she would be accepted at that congregation. I told her that there were congregants who were in the military, who supported the military, who were Republicans, and that they were in the minority. I told her they had found a way to be in the congregation and invited her to come and try it out. That exchange made me reflect again on how we accept the minority among us in our UU congregations. I thought of one of my friends from that same congregation whose husband works as a contractor for the Department of Defense, and how congregants have literally accosted him for his employment choice. I see my friend struggle with guilt about the ease of their lifestyle because of his Department of Defense salary. In a service at a recent annual General Assembly of Unitarian Universalists, it became clear how much that silence hurts those who are in the military. Unitarian Universalists had not felt our congregation safe to publicly bring their military life into their spiritual life. The prayer we had today was from that service. And these are words from Reverend Cynthia Kane from that service. You can't be a Unitarian and be in the military. In the early 1990s, Unitarian Universalist colleagues and congregants often expressed this sentiment to me and to my fellow Unitarian Universalist in uniform. The thought, however, that our faith and a profession within the military are incompatible is an unfortunate and erroneous sentiment. By way of example, here is this afternoon's muster. I'm going to ask you to do this. So, I ask you, please stand when the category with which you identify is called. Those people currently serving in any branch of the United States military on active duty. Those people serving in the reserves, National Guard, or auxiliary. Those who are retired from active duty, reserves, guard, or auxiliary. Anyone who has ever served any length of time in the United States military. Active duty dependents. Reserve and guard dependents. Retiree dependents. Anyone who has a family member or friend who is serving or has served in the United States military. All right. Thank you for participating. And I think it showed what I said earlier, it is so much the minority, and yet there are people here. Parker Palmer tells us that violence arises when we don't know what to do with our suffering. Violence arises when we have no one to accept us. Richard Rohr has written, "If you don't transform your pain, you will always transmit your pain." May we learn to create spaces and places here in our congregations where pain can be transformed. The first question might be, what are the hurts? This question is at the root of all transformation. What are the hurts? It may be the most powerful question in our work to heal the hurts of war, to keep us from making war with one another, and to help us stop the war in our own hearts. We are hungry, are we not? We are hungry for the spaces to speak from the heart, to share our hurts, and to listen to the hurts of another. To find those things that connect us across political and religious differences, across boundaries of race, gender, class, age. Places where we do not rush to judge or to fix. Powerful words from Reverend Kane to begin the healing. I've been holding on to a Living Pulpit magazine from my seminary, knowing I would someday need some help to be able to preach about war. The subtitle on the cover asks, "How do we preach about loving our country and loving our enemies too?" My answer to the woman who had asked me if she be welcome made me realize, again, how self-righteous Unitarian Universalist can be about peace. The first article in the Living Pulpit addressed self-righteousness as possibly only an irritating character flaw in a culture that sanctions every person's right to seek his or her own path to perfection. A vegetarian thinks that that's the only responsible eating choice and turns pale when her friends eat meat. Someone starts running and encourages his couch potato friends to get up and get fit. But when we turn our good into someone else's duty and judge them for failure to perform it according to our standards, then our wish for your well-being becomes darker and more dangerous. It becomes self-righteousness, and it's deadly for those who wield it and those who receive it. Sometimes it seems soft, with gossip, cruel humor, being defriended on Facebook. Sometimes it works systematically, consigning some people to live in grim buildings with broken plumbing, while others stroll neighborhoods full of thick green leaves, lawns, or systematically take the young persons from those grim buildings to the front line to be soldiers in endless wars. This Episcopal priest, Reverend Barbara Brown Taylor, says humility is the cure for self-righteousness that leads to pride and arrogance that makes us want to kill each other, whether the murder is subtle, like defriending someone, or as bloody as war. The only cure, she says, is to see each other as kin, united in the web of life. She's an Episcopal, but some of those sentiments sound very much like our Unitarian principles. A Mennonite preacher claims that nonviolence is not the way of the wimp. It is not the pattern of the weakling. He tells the story of one preacher, a guest preacher, speaking on the way of love rather than retaliation, when a young man shouted, "That's too soft. What we need is a revolution." And the preacher asked, "So you're a revolutionary?" "Yes." A revolutionary says there's a problem and I'm going to solve it, and if you get in my way, I'll kill you. Is that how you see it? "Well, yes." And the preacher says, "Well, I'm a revolutionary too. I see the problem and the solution, and if you get in my way, I'll lay down my life for you." Who's soft now? In this same version of Living Pulpit, a Union Theological Seminary professor looks at Reinald Niebuhr, who was in our story, his changing views. He went from pacifism to just war, to justifiable war, and back again to nonviolent actions. I think many of us go through similar places of where we are with peace and war. A Baptist preacher, an activist, used the refrain from the Motown protest song during the Vietnam War, "What's It Good For?" I had to go back and listen to it on YouTube to see if I could remember that one. Irvin Starr. He wants us to look at the cost of war and encourages ministers to speak from the pulpit about war and raise that question over and over. War. What's it good for? Because the future of our planet is hanging in the balance. Another professor quotes Dr. King about what the church can do about the hell of war. Dr. King says, in the terrible midnight of war, humans have knocked on the door of the church to ask for the bread of peace, but the church has often disappointed them. What more pathetically reveals the irrelevancy of the church in present-day world affairs than its witness regarding war? In a world gone mad with arms build up, chauvinistic passions, and imperialistic exploitation, the church has either endorsed these activities or remained appallingly silent. Is this true for Unitarian Universalists? What have we done, and what are we doing? Here's a brief look at our past. Something new to me, Aidan Ballou, a distant cousin of the very famous Hosea Ballou, Universalist, wrote a book in 1846 called Christian Non-Resistance. And that book is generally acknowledged as influencing Leo Tolstoy, who then influenced Gandhi. His Christian language might be hard for some, but he presents quite a radical argument of total non-cooperation with evil. He started the Hopedale community. He refused to vote in national or state elections, as that was a form of cooperation with a system wherein the chief executive was commander and chief of the military. This book is a fascinating look at our faith's integral early involvement in the development of the way of life, of nonviolence and peace. James Luther Adams is widely thought to be the most famous UU theologian of the last century. And he applies his theology to the UU tradition of social witness. His essay is regarded as a definitive discussion of our sources and historical involvement in acting to achieve justice using interpersonal connections and group definition of meaning and the responsible exercise of power. And finally, John Hames Holmes, who was a political activist, a pacifist, and a preacher at the community church in New York City for 54 years. He wrote a book called My Gandhi. And this tribute to Gandhi describes Holmes' personal views of Gandhi and the few direct encounters between them, his description of why he considered Gandhi a saint and why the world mourned Gandhi's death are especially poignant. He wrote of Gandhi, "It is not often in human history that men join at once the inner and the outer life and thus make saint and statesman one. But when they do, they shake the world and turn the tides of destiny." In this century, one of my favorite books is The Proverbs of Ashes, Violence, Redemptive Suffering, and the Search for What Saves Us. It's written by Rebecca Parker, who's the first female president of a seminary, one of our UU seminaries, Tarking School for the Ministry, and her writing partner, Rita Brock. They aim to show that the theological assertion that God required the death of Jesus to save the world sanctions violence. They present this theology, and then they tell stories of their own lives, their lives as pastors and very personal stories, emphasizing the violence they've encountered. In your insert, in your order of service, I gave you a statement of conscience. This is the most recent thing that Unitarian Universalists have done. Every year at General Assembly, any congregant, any congregation can come forward and say, there's something we need to look at, that we need to study and do action on. And this one, peacemaking, began in 2006. And it was so big that they changed the way that we do this and allowed it 4 years for congregations to study and figure out. It's something that many congregations don't realize that we do, and something hopefully when Michael comes back from General Assembly this year, he will bring. I know he has been working all this year on immigration justice, because that's what this General Assembly is about. So there are still things that can be done. You can see the statement in there of what all of the people across the country studying this came up with, of how you use might look at peacemaking and war. Basically, they say that peacemaking depends on individuals and their ability to encounter and handle conflict effectively and without violence. Like our story with Marissa, it starts that simple. How do you handle the conflict? It's not synonymous with lack of conflict, because conflict exists everywhere. One of the ways is using nonviolent communication. That is something this congregation has done in the past few years, has had circles. A lot of people want to change that language to compassionate communication, not wanting to use the word nonviolent. I don't know if any of you have done it. I have led classes in it. It's really hard changing your language, and language really makes a difference. Peacemaking does not mean simply preventing violence. It means building connections and relationships in which the viewpoints, needs, and wishes of all sides are understood and respected, so that harmony and trust are the result. How can we do this in our personal relationships, in our congregations, in society, and internationally? You can find lots of ways on the UUA website. There are pages and pages of that. But I will tell you, the first thing that comes to mind is what Lao Tzu says about where peace is. If there is to be peace in the world, there has to be peace in the nations. If there is to be peace in the nations, there has to be peace in the cities. If there's peace in the cities, there has to be peace in the home. And if there's peace in the home, it has to start in the heart. So we can remember that prayer of serenity, to know what we can do to gain serenity. Let us hearken back to the roots of Memorial Day, to Decoration Day, where families gathered to decorate the graves of their ancestors, to break bread together, to picnic, to restore their common connections. Let us remember, too, that this day is a special day from our Christian and Jewish roots, the day the law was given to Moses at Sinai. And among Christians, today is Pentecost, which commemorates the descent of the Holy Spirit upon the 12 apostles. I don't know about you, but Pentecost has been something that I have been challenged with understanding. So I've decided to think of it as the followers of Jesus finally understanding what he was saying, to love one another, to treat each other like neighbors. And that's what we do on Memorial Day. May we see the whole world as our neighbors and our kin, and find ways to communicate compassionately so that we're not studying war, but practicing peace. May it be so. Salom, Shante, Aseh.